I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is The Connection. Few women have sent men on as many wild goose chases as the Queen of Sheba. Nicholas Clapp spent 4 years wandering the lands of Yemen, Syria, Ethiopia, Israel, and even France, where he searched out her face on a wine bottle, looking for his dusky queen. All this for a woman who only gets brief mention in the Old Testament. Who was the Queen of Sheba? And why have men written with such passion about her throughout the ages? Glorified in scripture, demonized in art, eroticized in verse, the Queen of Sheba has been many things to many people. She was a lusty demon in the Middle Ages when slave trades and crusades gave women and foreigners a bad name, and then redeemed as a cheerful dancing girl in the 1800s by enterprising businessmen trying to sex up their circuses with biblical figures doing the hoochie-coochie. Today, grandmothers still use her to warn against overweening pride, but feminists embrace her as one of their own, a gal with her very own kingdom. The Queen of Sheba is stuck in our cultural consciousness, but few know how she got there. Connection listeners, who was this ancient, powerful, delectable desert queen? Is she merely a collective fantasy of a country obsessed with mummies, pharaohs, anything that comes from the distant land of the sand? Or does she point the way to a time when women had power and were not afraid to use it? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nicholas Clapp, author of Sheba Through the Desert in Search of the Legendary Queen, is in the studio today, along with Carol Fontaine, professor of Hebrew Scriptures at the Andover Newton Theological School and a Queen of Sheba expert. Welcome to The Connection, Nicholas Clapp and Carol Fontaine. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Nicholas Clapp, why on earth did you spend 4 years chasing this woman and her fable around the desert? Did you ever find the Queen of Sheba?
I think I did. And she's wonderful. Once you get, as Carol can attest, once you get intrigued by her, there's no end to her myth and her story. But also, on the archaeological front, there's a lot of discovery going on right now. In that 3 years ago, ask an archaeologist dealing in the Middle East, and he would have said, there is no Queen of Sheba. Mm. But now she has a culture that's dated to her time. It's rich. It was rich and powerful, had long-range trade, and the Bible now makes eminent sense.
Well, describe it as best we can, at least. What was her time, and who was this legendary figure, maybe not legend?
Well, the time would have been about 950 B.C. That would have been the time of King Solomon. And the Bible account, if you read it on the surface, she comes to admire his wisdom. They have a good time. They probably get along pretty well after hours, and she goes home. If you kind of scratch that a little bit, you find what seems to be going down is a trade deal, that she has two incredibly valuable commodities, which she wants to distribute to the classical world, which are gold and frankincense.
Carol Fontaine, set up for us in our mind's eye, what was the geographic and cultural world of the Queen of Sheba, of King Solomon at that time? What's it look like? Where was the activity? Where was the action? Were these new trade routes? What was going on?
Yes, well, in the ancient world, we have a part of Arabia known as Arabia Felix. It's the only part of Arabia that receives significant rainfall, and this is one of the areas where
north,
we
south,
place,
east, west.
It's on the west side, nearest to Egypt, and so Sheba has been placed pretty convincingly for as coming from this part of the world because this is where the incense is.
Now, in the book, you describe the big technological breakthrough of the era as the load-bearing camel saddle, if I got that correctly, saying that for the first time, camels could carry large loads long distances. How did that bring the Queen of Sheba, that you describe, Carol, into contact with King Solomon, and who was King Solomon?
Okay, King Solomon, the question is, was there a Queen Solomon? He's under a great deal of assault.
Right.
King Solomon.
Is that right?
I mean, he's clearly very large in the Bible. He looms large throughout all of Israel's founding stories. You're asking whether he existed or not?
Not me, but an awful lot of other people are.
That's right. We have a group of scholars known as the New Historians.
All right.
And they have really helped out the standard Bible specialists in helping us think about what we can really know about history. And I would say that in the past, we've been very naive in accepting Bible stories at face value and assuming their historicity. Now we're beginning to say, well, you know, do we really have the kind of archaeology that supports a Solomon in the 10th century in Jerusalem? And that's being reviewed.
Well, so how does Solomon emerge as we look at this with an eye toward more historical accuracy?
Well, the terms that's being used a lot was hill country chieftain, that Jerusalem would have been maybe 10 acres, 800 people. He would have been a very bright guy. He certainly wrote wonderfully, and he may have fleetingly unified some fractious tribes. And what's interesting about Sheba is she comes as kind of a wild card into this equation. She comes from outside the Bible, and as you know, until very recently, she was pretty much dismissed as being real, and now she's getting very real. Her civilization is unquestionably real, and it with what may happen is the old story of a man of dubious reputation, Solomon, being redeemed by a good woman.
Hold that thought. We're making the Queen of Sheba connection on The Connection at 1-800-423-8255. One of the only women in the Old Testament to really hold power and dominion. Connection listeners, is this just another legend that feeds male fantasies, or is this an icon that comes down to us, perhaps something we can take nourishment from even today as a more feminist icon? So here we are. We've got the ancient region. King Solomon, or one heck of a bright and powerful chieftain, and across the desert sands comes the Queen of Sheba. Is that what we're looking at here?
Mm-hmm.
She shows up, and what's the meeting like? How would they have seen each other? Carol?
Well, most of the foreign women who hold power in the ancient world don't just arrive with one maid and companion. They show up at your front gate with about 300 people and all kinds of elephants and camels and wonderful gifts. In fact, I think Solomon might have been a bit overawed, because at this period in time, Jerusalem is really a pretty podunky kind of place. Mm-hmm. Sheba would have appeared out of the desert as this magnificent woman at the head of a fabulous caravan. I would imagine Solomon was very grateful that she bothered to notice him.
And what was she doing there at the head of this great caravan? She's traveling in style. She's clearly, from the biblical account, come, as you say, loaded with all the deluxe trappings you could ask for. But what was the Queen of Sheba doing reaching out to this chieftain north of her kingdom?
Well, I would agree with Mr. Clapp again. I think she is there to make trade agreements. If you look at the passage in the Bible, it's also mentioned along with Hiram of Phoenicia and Tyre. And he clearly had trade agreements with Solomon, because that's where we got the cedars of Lebanon to build the temple. So I think they've put all of the stories about Solomon and fabulous important rulers right in the same place in the Hebrew Bible. I think this is not a pleasure trip for Sheba. I think she's a smart woman in a man's world, and she's there dealing for her people.
She's a head of state, and she's on a trade mission, and one that really matters. She's riding the latest technology, the load-bearing camel saddle. And what does she want, Nicholas Clapp, from King Solomon?
I think if you look at from her point of view, she sets out from Southern Arabia. She has these exotic goods. She wants to get them to the classical world. But the further she gets from home, the more vulnerable she is. The more bandits can attack caravans and just the physical demands of the journey. So when she gets up there, she doesn't want any trouble. Even a little no-account tribe could do in her caravan. So she, one good possibility that she needs a middleman. She needs somebody to deal with.
Looking for a forward post, for an ally, if you will, in her trade ambitions.
Mm-hmm. And also, when you're in the ancient world and you're trying to move any goods from Africa or Arabia north, you basically have to talk to the folks in Syro-Palestine, because that is geographically where the two flattest trade routes cross. So if you're trying to go somewhere, you've got to go through that particular piece of territory. And Solomon is the man to talk to.
And the meeting is of such import that it echoes down to us across millennia via the Bible, which brings us so many stories from from Great Yore. It's only 13 lines.
That's right.
And we'll get into all the resonance of those lines across the years, the resonance of a woman of power and dominion reading a man who's given tremendous stature in of course, biblical scripture. But describe, Carol Fontaine, for us, if you will, those 13 lines. What is the record, the biblical record, of the meeting of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba?
Right. Thank you. In fact, the Bible's statements about Sheba contain a lot of extraneous material. One place, she sounds just like Solomon speaking in Proverbs. She makes a lovely little blessing, which could have come right out of the Book of Psalms. The rest of it seems to be a narrative historical report. But
give
most
us the, give us the point by point of the interaction, the little bit we get in the Bible.
Yes.
How do they interact?
Well, the authors have done us a beautiful job at putting in enough euphemisms and places where we can fill in the gaps that this is really where the sexual story comes from. First of all, we learn that Sheba comes to Solomon to put hard questions to him, to test his wisdom. And that word come, just as in modern English, has the euphemism of standing for a sexual encounter.
This Bible has got a lot between its covers.
Oh, does it ever. Further, we later hear that Solomon gives Sheba all she desired, and then she goes back to her home. Well, this all she desired, this is taken by many rabbinical commentators and medieval commentators to her desire must have been for Solomon. Real wishful thinking here. I think she wanted trade agreements. They think she wants Solomon in her bed.
And that argument surely echoes down through all the tellings
exactly.
of this story through the ages. As a feminist, are we offended by the sexual interpretation of the meeting?
Well, certainly in the ancient Near East, all kinds of trade agreements were sealed with a kiss. Normally, you give your daughter to marry the person you just made the agreement with. Here now, we've actually put it, though, into the hands of Sheba herself. I think that the sources are mixed as to whether or not this was a willing encounter or whether or not Solomon forced Sheba, knowing that she was honorable, and that was the only way he could get her.
Nicholas Clapp, so she meets Solomon, and they have an exchange of trade parley or something more.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know.
Riddles, at least.
Riddles, and soon she's on her way. I was struck by how the Bible then makes a great point of describing Solomon's enormous wealth, as though they have to brag that he too was wealthy, not just this loaded queen from the desert. And she's off again. What else do we need to take away from those 13 lines?
Well, one thing about 13 lines, there's this wonderful sexual overtone to it. But otherwise, it's a little dull. God isn't mad. Nobody's out of joint. There's no pillaging or anything, that good Old Testament stuff going on. So on that grounds, that is a vote for its authenticity as having kind of a overtone of a court record.
Sometimes dullness means it may be real.
Dullness means real, yeah.
Because, of course, the Queen of Sheba has no dull connotations. It's all about splendor and power.
Mm-hmm. And one thing it does say is that she brought more treasure to Jerusalem than Jerusalem would ever see. So that's an admission right there.
That's right.
Who was numero uno.
Is there any archaeological record that, in fact, this trade relationship then did blossom? Do we know?
We know that was the initiation at that time of the long-distance frankincense trades, yeah. And the camel saddle you mentioned made that possible.
Now, we did have a...
Carol, we'll come right to it. We're making the Queen of Sheba connection this morning. Fable, fact, fiction, and what does she mean to us today? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection on NPR.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is The Connection. We're making the Queen of Sheba connection this morning with Nicholas Clapp, author of a new book called Queen of Sheba, and Carol Fontaine from a background in scriptural studies, which is helping us unwind the myth and fable here. I can still remember my grandmother saying it. Who does she think she is? The Queen of Sheba. That way to bring down a woman, but yet, as often as not, throughout history, she has also riled people up, and she's taken people on quests, not the least of whom, perhaps, is our guest this morning, Nicholas Clapp. You spent 4 years chasing all across the Middle East after this Will-o'-the-Wisp legend, what got under your skin here? You made me think of old Wilfred Thesiger and Harry Philby and all the folks who get caught up in the endless allure of Arabian exotic. Is that still what it's about? Are you on your own Indiana Jones quest? And have you fallen in love with the Queen of Sheba? What took you out into the desert sands?
Yes to all of the above. I thought actually it wouldn't be that hard. As we mentioned, only 13 lines of the Bible. How much can you make of it? But it's still going on. I haven't gotten to the bottom of it yet, nor has Carol, I'm sure. So what I did set out to do was to go to every place that anybody has seriously claimed she came from. And that was basically four different areas: Syria, northern Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, and Yemen. With the idea that once you actually see a place, once you talk to the locals, you get a different perspective. You mentioned, was the Queen of Sheba's relationship with Solomon willing or unwilling? A couple of years ago, I sat driving through Ethiopia and witnessed a very heated argument between two Ethiopians as to whether she was willing or whether she was entrapped. So you do get this wonderful perspective, and it was quite different than what scholars would generally say.
ID on Ephraim. And did you find the Queen of Sheba you set out to look for, or was she something else?
Well, I found a civilization, and a lot of other people are finding it too. It was known to exist, but not in her period. And there's been recently, it has to do with some ancient texts, but that civilization has been dated well back to before the time of Solomon. So that means she really could exist now. And I think it could be tomorrow, it could be never, but I think there's a good prospect we'll find actual artifacts like her tomb or her throne that prove beyond a doubt that she did exist.
In American culture, she certainly hasn't gone away. Look on the web and you'll see thousands and thousands of websites with some kind of reference to the Queen of Sheba. But by the same token, she's at the margins of our thinking about the Bible and about legendary or not so legendary biblical figures. But there are other cultures in which she plays a very important and central role. Carol Fontaine, tell us about that.
Well, in both Islamic texts and in African texts from Ethiopia, Sheba appears as a woman of their own people. So naturally, they're going to think about her more differently than those of us who are based in the biblical traditions, which see her as an outsider. So I think that you have to look culturally and see which group of people is telling the story and what relationship do they have to Sheba. In the Quran, Sheba actually occurs in one of the surahs, a surah called The Ant. And we find there that in the Arabic, her glory throne is described in the exact same words as Allah's glorious throne. This is quite an endorsement of Sheba as a woman of power. Exactly.
She has a much more exotic presentation in the Quran than in the Bible.
Well, in fact, the Quran is a little bit sketchy, and then later folk tales fill in the gaps.
Connection listeners, we're making the Queen of Sheba connection, an icon of eroticism in some Western culture, but of profound importance as a symbol of female power and long lineage in other parts of the world. We're joined now on the phone by Dr. Ephraim Isaac, director of the Institute for Semitic Studies in Princeton, New Jersey. Good morning, Dr. Isaac.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. We're plumbing the story of the Queen of Sheba, looking for its resonance and relevance. Give us, if you will, some of the Ethiopian perspective on the Queen of Sheba, fact and fiction.
All right. First, let me make a couple of corrections from what I had heard.
Please.
It also gives you the Ethiopian perspective. One, her name was not Sheba. Sheba was the name of the country.
Indeed.
Her name is not mentioned in the Bible. She is called Makeda in Ethiopian.
Makeda.
And the Arabs call her Bilqis.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is Sheba was not a country. There wasn't really at that time, even Arabia Felix is a name that was given to that region in Roman times. In earlier days, there were some city-states there. There were about four or five city-states. from the Ethiopian perspective, which actually agrees with our study of archaeology, part of Yemen and northern Ethiopia were more or less a unified state.
So that is divided by the Red Sea, but connected by trade and by political relations.
Yes, lands in ancient times connected by sea were more unified than those separated by deserts and mountains.
Easier to sail the ocean than to trot across the sand.
That's right. And I have been to Yemen. I've lived in Ethiopia. And the connection between the two countries, historical, cultural, linguistic, is very strong. The Sabaean inscriptions, some of which I have studied, also are found in both regions. I have been to Marib myself. Marib is the area where the Arabs say, the Yemenis say, it was the capital of the queen. And I have also been to Aksum, where the Ethiopians say that was the capital of the queen. I have never had any problem. I have, in fact, written about this in a few places. Mm. That both Yemen and Ethiopia can claim the Queen of Sheba. I have no problem with that. If we look at the historical relationship between these two shores of the Red Sea.
And talk to us about the Queen of Sheba, or Makeda's, if you will, legacy as it's understood in Ethiopia today. As I understand, she is part of the founding story of Ethiopia's monarchy, that the offspring of a relationship between Solomon and the Queen of Sheba was first in that line. Is that correct? And how is she seen today?
Well, in fact, in no culture is the Queen of Sheba as important as in the Ethiopian culture. As it was mentioned before, in the Bible we only have a few lines about her. We have in Targum Sheni, Targum to Esther, some legends from Jewish literature. We have in the Quran, in the surah that was mentioned before by Professor
Carol Fontaine with us.
Carol Fontaine, but. In both the Hebrew and the Arabic literature, she really is more or less a semi-mythical figure. Only in the Ethiopic literature is she really a real distinguished world leader. Additionally, the work in which the story about the Queen of Sheba is described is a very extensive, large work. Written in the Ge'ez language and translated, of course, in some European languages going back to the end of the last century. It's called Kibrenagast, or The Glory of Kings.
Yes.
And scholars who have studied comparatively these legends in Ethiopic, in Hebrew, and in Arabic have pointed out that, for instance, the fact that the communication between her and King Solomon is described more or less as having been done through a hoopoe bird.
A hoopoe
bird.
Oh, a hoopoe bird, yes.
A hoopoe bird, yes.
Yes.
Is less realistic than, let's say, for instance, the Ethiopic legend, which actually describes an ongoing trade between the two nations.
Yes.
And that there was a trader whose name was Tamarin. And that Tamarin was sailing back and forth in the Red Sea, and he was bringing news of the queen to King Solomon's place, to the land of Israel, and he was taking back stories about King Solomon and his wisdom and his glory to the land of Sheba, or to the queen.
Stories that come to us even today. I want to pull Nicholas Clapp in here. You chased the story through any number of countries. Did you see a difference today? I mean, we know what American culture, popular culture, does to something like Sheba. Your book points out it's the most popular name for cat food, for heaven's sakes. But there's more resonance than that. But in the Middle East, how did you see the differences there in the contemporary understanding, even awareness, of the Queen of Sheba? Nicholas Clapp.
She's very much in everybody's consciousness, very much in Ethiopia, very much in Yemen. And I think we're unanimous that about the United Kingdom idea between Ethiopia and Yemen, with a lot of archaeology yet to be done. But some has been accomplished, and it's all pointing in that direction. And in Ethiopia, it's like she just existed last generation.
Mm-hmm.
And you do get great discussions about her. She's like somebody's great aunt. She's not a remote figure at all. And Yemen, she's a little perhaps more remote, but as you mentioned, it is the most popular name for cat food here, but it's also the most popular name for little girl in Yemen. And the name is Bilkis or Balkis.
Yes.
And if you were to go into a Yemeni marketplace and say Balkis, all little girls in sight, or half the little girls in sight, would come running.
And Carol Fontaine, what does it mean today when someone names their daughter Balkis in the Yemen? What does this suggest?
It suggests that she will be a woman of power, someone who can make her way in a man's world, and yet she will have all of the feminine virtues of beauty and allure. Balkis is...
What's not to like?
Exactly. Now, what you need to know is that that scholars believe the name Balkis is made from an older root that stands for the word concubine. Once again, we get a little bit of sexual overloading, even in the name.
And a mixed message coming down through the centuries. Connection listeners, we're making the Queen of Sheba connection. Power, dominion, eroticism, it's all there. We've got callers stacking up. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Joseph is on the line. Joseph, are you there?
Yeah. Yes, I'm here.
Fire away, Joseph.
Pardon me?
Do you have a question?
Yeah, sure.
Sure.
My question is, through African studies, there is a legend. I don't know whether any research has been done to validate this claim, particularly concerning Ethiopia. There's a doctor from Ethiopia. I forgot his name, and I would like to address this question.
Yes, yes, we will. And what is your question, Joseph?
My question is there any proof that the Queen of Sheba was genetically connected to Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia?
Dr. Ephraim Isaac at Princeton, Joseph pulls us into the tricky realm of proof, asking if indeed there is evidence that the Queen of Sheba is, in his words, genetically linked to the emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia. What are we to make of the founding legend and in fact, in this regard?
Let me preface this by saying, first of all, as a person who's studied Arabic, Jewish, and Ethiopic literature, there's absolutely no comparison that in Ethiopic literature throughout the centuries, the Queen of Sheba has always played a very, very prominent role.
Mm-hmm.
This is not comparable at all to what you find in Hebrew or Arabic literature.
A much larger figure, you're saying, in
yes,
the Ethiopian.
Well, she is a very present and very real part of Ethiopian history.
Yes.
Let me just say that the fact that the name Bilkis appeals, you know, among small children doesn't. In fact, it's only more recently that Yemen, because of there was a big story in Wall Street Journal, I think, a couple of years ago, and I did respond to that, somehow or other she's been discovered to be important for trade purposes. But I mean, there are all these little references here and there. Again, in Hebrew literature, of course, the Queen of Sheba is mentioned in the Bible, in some midrashic stories, for instance.
I think we're prepared to share the Queen of Sheba this morning, and no doubt she towers above all in Ethiopian history. But what about the archaeological record? You know, depending on your perspective, you may or may not care. But Joseph asks, is there archaeological
let me say something about that.
Link between the queen and Haile Selassie, a more contemporary monarch?
Well, I can answer that by simply saying, of course, all kings of Ethiopia going back to Abu Salih in the 13th century already, and some Arabic writers in medieval times have said that the kings of Ethiopia claim that they are descendants of Queen of Sheba and King Solomon. Abu Salih, in fact, there is a very direct quotation where he says the Ethiopians say the Queen of Sheba came from there and that she is the mother of the first king of Ethiopia. And this is very, very well documented. And the Portuguese who came to Ethiopia in the medieval, in Renaissance period also report this. The kings of Ethiopia have claimed to be descendants of the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon is not a question in the mind of Ethiopians.
Right,
and
Joseph
accept this as a fact.
Joseph, thank you for your question. It looks like the claim to lineage is as good as as any.
Well, I think we need a little genetic evidence. A little bit of DNA would be helpful. I think everyone makes claims.
I'm talking about the claim of the Ethiopians.
It's very ancient, yes.
There is no way of proving, you see, when we talk about people who lived 3,000 years ago, mentioning that this is a very significant sentence. It's in the constitution of Ethiopia, actually, that, of course, has now been superseded by the recent constitution that says all rulers of Ethiopia have to descend from Solomon and Sheba. I am just saying the facts of Ethiopian history, whether that is historically proven or not, it's the same question about whether one says Romus and Romulus were real or
right.
not real.
It's a fact on the ground of Ethiopian culture.
And they're worthwhile in that culture.
Yes. We have a call from Bill in Buffalo, New York. Bill, welcome to The Connection.
Good morning. I have three quick questions. First of all,
Bill, we're short on time. Give us your first
physical description of Sheba, the Queen of Sheba, and where was Sheba located? Was it a region or was it a city or town? And finally, how do women, for those of us who don't study the ancient world, how do women come to power in a region like, in an area like that, that seems to be so dominated by men? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. We're going to break in a second, but let's take first this question of images of Sheba, of the Queen of Sheba. Are there remaining images of the Queen of Sheba, Carol Fontaine? And if so, what do they tell us?
Well, certainly in the Ethiopian tradition, we have a very well-fleshed-out iconographic history of Sheba, and we see her there, and she's quite beautiful. By and large, we don't get a lot of descriptions of Sheba in the Arabic materials. She is supposed to have very hairy legs, and she is the origin of ancient Near Eastern depilatories.
Depilatories?
Hair removal techniques.
Oh, Solomon was upset about her legs.
Yes, Solomon didn't really want to go to bed with her as hairy as she was, so we had to find a way to get rid of her
and
hair.
And in spite of that, she stands tall among ancient women of the world. We want to thank Dr. Ephraim Isaac at Princeton for joining us this morning. Thank you very much, Dr. Isaac. We're making the Queen of Sheba connection this morning. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. A woman from out of the mists of ancient time, a woman of power and dominion and hairy legs. More when we come back on The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is The Connection. We're making the Queen of Sheba connection this morning. Are you looking for an icon to hang your feminism on, or maybe your erotic fantasies? She seems to serve all purposes. Just before our break, caller Bill asked us, what about this woman in power in ancient times? How common was that? We picture a Semitic culture with men kind of large and in charge, but here's a powerful woman. Was that a commonplace of that time, or was it something extraordinary? Nicholas Clapp.
Actually, there are, I think, well over 40 cases of Arab queens, you know, major and minor, that have been documented, particularly by Boccaccio.
So what on earth happened? I mean, look around the region today, and you don't exactly see, let's see, since Golda Meir, who do we have?
Yeah.
What, Carol Fontaine, give us some of the history, if you will, of the status of women in Arabian culture, particularly as it comes to ruling, to holding power.
Well, we certainly have very ancient documents from the 9th and 8th century about warrior queens coming from the region of Arabia. And they were so powerful, they actually gave the Assyrians trouble. And the Assyrians were clearly the dominating empire of that time. So we have a queen named Shamshi and one named Zabibi, and they're out in the desert leading their men.
Were these maternalistic cultures from the dawn of time?
No, by no means.
So how on earth do women take charge?
Yeah, usually the way women get into that power situation is they marry into it or they're born into it. You could be, for example, the daughter of the king who just died, and you could engineer things nicely so that you marry a very weak man and you are the one who's really the power. Sheba seems in some of the Arabic materials to have come to power in that way. And in some of those sources, she's also supposed to be the daughter of a genie. So she has very magical powers.
Mm-hmm. Mystical powers there.
And there's a wonderful hair-raising story in the Arab version about how she did come to power, and that she was raised in the desert by angels and genies. She came to town when she came of age and found that the state of Saba was ruled by an evil and lascivious
king.
So
she gets rid of him.
So
and how does she do that?
Well, what he needs is he demands a maiden a week to ravish. So she kind of semi-volunteers, and everybody says, Sheba,
that's Belkis. A diet.
Yeah, stay away from that, but she goes to the palace, and he kind of chases her up staircase after staircase into his little nest of pillows and puffs, and starts making his moves, takes off his little curly-toed slippers, takes off his turban, and then she reaches for his belt, takes his dagger, runs it through his heart, goes down to the palace kitchen, gets a big knife, comes back, cuts off his head, goes to the palace window, a crowd is assembled, and she flings the head out across the town square, and there's kind of a stunned silence, and then somebody says Sheba, and somebody else says Sheba, none but Sheba. That's...
Long live the queen.
Connection listeners, this is a woman who doesn't mess around. I want to come back to how all that power was received and responded to in Western culture over the years. But before we do, we've got a lot of callers here. Rachel is on the line. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Rachel is on the line from New York. Rachel, are you with us?
Yes, I am. How are you?
Fine. What have you have to share with us on the Queen of Sheba, Rachel?
Well, I actually had an article about the Queen of Sheba that... ran in Lilith magazine, which is the National Jewish Feminist magazine.
Lilith, yes, sure.
And which was picked up specifically because there was this realization that the character of the Queen of Sheba was such fertile ground for the contemporary feminist community and the Jewish feminist community that hadn't been until recently particularly explored.
And what is that fertile ground? What are the characteristics that you found there that brings the Queen of Sheba in as an icon for feminists today?
Yeah, well, it's this this really momentous encounter between the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon, where the Queen of Sheba, who is a woman, who is a foreign woman, really challenges King Solomon, asserts her power in this context, and asks these hard questions. And then you have to, and then the question is, well, what happens when people who feel like outsiders today ask these hard questions, when they assert their own power and challenge people that seem to be more on the inside?
What could be more contemporary than women and men wrestling with this balance of sexuality, of power, of new challenges to male domination and authority? Carol Fontaine, how do you see the Queen of Sheba playing out in feminist circles today? Are you close to that? Rachel has said, here's someone we can look up to. Is that gaining currency?
I would say so. I think not only do we have the connections that Rachel is talking about, which is a very interesting political moment where we see a woman show to advantage, but also in Jewish mythology and folklore, Sheba has been connected with the demon Lilith, who is a night-flying demon, a female who searches for men so she can steal their seed, and is also preys upon recently born babies.
So we've got Lilith, the magazine, Lilith Fair, the girl rockers on parade, and now
bingo.
You say the Queen of Sheba is connected to Lilith. By connected, do you mean she is a form of a presentation of Lilith, or is there some different connection?
Well, I think in later sources, in the Kabbalah, the Jewish mystical material, they give the personal name of Sheba as being Lilith, and they clearly identify her with this demon, because who else would have the chutzpah to come and ask wise King Solomon a bunch of riddles?
Thank you, Rachel. The connections with the Queen of Sheba go on and on. I want to turn first to this issue of how the biblical image of a woman of power and dominion was received and interpreted through later Western cultural writing, we've got some hint of this. She was eroticized. Perhaps you see a woman of power, and the way for men who can't handle that is to get her flat on her back. Nicholas Clapp, tell us a bit about what you found on the trail of the Queen of Sheba in terms of her presentation in Western literature, music, even contemporary culture.
It's kind of a great arc of glorification, demonization, and finally, only in the last maybe 120 years, redemption. And the glorification hits an all-time high in the Middle Ages, where, you know, she gets mixed up with Lilith, but she gets mixed up with a lot of other people as well. As scholars, it's kind of a dull term for this, conflation.
Yes, coming together of two things.
Yeah, but in medieval theology, she is identified with the Virgin Mary. She becomes Christ's bride. She is identified with Christ himself.
She spots the true cross when she's on her way to Jerusalem and bows down to worship it.
You know, I have to admit, I began to get overwhelmed with these conflations. I mean, the Queen of Sheba as Lilith, as Christ himself, how does that come in? We know that in the New Testament, she actually shows up on Judgment Day, called the Queen of the South, and there she is, I think, shipping off to hell everyone who's not on board. How does she reclaim such a central position in the New Bible's New Testament, and how this conflation with Jesus Christ, this is beginning to stretch our capacity for imagination?
Well, I think one of the things that's going on there is that we often see the Bible use an outsider's perceptions to shame people on the inside who just don't get it. So when Jesus says, yes, you wicked men of Jerusalem, one day at the last judgment, Jonah's going to stand up and the Queen of the South will stand up.
So everybody else gets it,
everybody,
guys.
Even these outsiders get it. But, oh, my gosh, you people are really stupid. So what a wonderful thing. I mean, you're not as bright as a woman. This is a great way to shame your audience. But there's another source from the ancient world, and that is Josephus, Flavius Josephus, who wrote in the first century A.D. and wrote the history of the Jewish Wars. And he was a Jew who wrote for a Roman audience, which is kind of interesting. And he speaks of Sheba in one of the most powerful and positive ways. He talks about her as a great philosopher who wanted to see things for herself. That is, she does her own thinking. And he tells the story so that the Romans, who've never heard of this woman, can appreciate what a great and wonderful person we had in Jerusalem, Solomon, such that somebody like Sheba would want to come and visit him.
So we see the visage of this great desert queen used through the centuries to say, hey, she paid attention,
That's right. Should
you.
And beyond that, she's a great every woman. Or if you want to
the extent that every woman is a queen of her own.
Or Harry.
Yeah. or also, it's everything about a woman that has ever puzzled a man. And
well, that's a long list indeed. Connection listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255. We've got a Queen of Sheba crowd at the gates. Misrach is on the line. Misrach, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I just want to mention Professor Isaac didn't get a time maybe to explain. There were a lot of Ethiopian queen beside Queen of Sheba. There were, I think, at least about four. I think the earliest maybe like 150 years ago. But there were Ethiopian women who were queen and who governed. I mean, currently Ethiopia is going, you know, backward. You know, the men are dominating and they don't want to give any power to women. But ancient.
You tell them, Misrach.
Yeah.
Sheba is a good role model in that situation.
But you're saying that's not the history. There is a tradition of women with their hand on the lever. I still wonder what has happened to that. What brought us to this pass today where we don't have that going on? What was it in the historical culture that's missing in the contemporary mix of monarchs and rulers that makes it harder for women in that region, not to mention the rest of the world, to be at the top?
Well, I think in the ancient world, anytime we see a woman who is ruling and has power, she also has access to her own economic resources. In other words, she's got a budget. She is someone who can make a deal and make it stick. I think when we move to the Industrial Revolution and we begin to see economics move away from the household where women have control over it, we see women lose power in the public sphere. In some ways, it was easier to come to power in ancient times as a woman.
Ms. Rock, I hear perhaps an Ethiopian lilt in your voice. Did you grow up with an awareness of the Queen of Sheba?
Oh, very much, yes.
And what did she mean to you?
I mean, she's a role model. She was, a ruler. So, I mean, everybody knows about Queen of Sheba. It's just, it's a part of history.
And now we know a bit more ourselves. Thanks for calling, Ms. Rock. Thanks very much. So here we are. The Desert Queen, across all these centuries, even millennia at this point, still resonating with us. I guess she doesn't have a PR agent, but if you get even 13 lines in the Bible, you've got a pretty good platform from which to resonate. Let's talk for just a minute about the record that's emerging, I guess, along the shores of the Red Sea in contemporary Yemen. What's going on archaeologically, Nicholas Clapp? You've been in the area.
Yes, it's very exciting. There's a big expedition right now excavating a site that's traditionally been called the Moon Temple of the Queen of Sheba. And it's emerging as, my own opinion, this was the site of her winter palace, and that another site is the site of her summer palace. And the great archaeological potential is that the Sheban or Sabaean civilization that went on for 1,600 years, not one royal burial has yet been found. So probably either...
Does that lead us to doubt or lead us to expectation?
Great expectation. They exist. Mm-hmm. And it's not in some remote valley. The Bedouin would have found that. So it's either in or around one of two temples or both temples. And it's just a matter of time before the first royal tomb is found, and then it could be the next day that Sheba's tomb is found.
There's a
and,
challenge for you young archaeologists across mm-hmm. the world. It's still waiting to crack open that tomb of the Queen of Sheba and all the other monarchs of that era. Is the excavation underway? Can we see pillars standing there? What's emerged from the sand?
Yes, this one temple that's under excavation now, it's in a giant moon shape. It's about 2.5 times the size of the Parthenon. It's got, they've been crumbled a little bit, but 50-foot walls. But her level is probably about 30 feet down through the sand. So it may take a little while.
Connection listeners, stay tuned for the future reports on the Queen of Sheba. Will the fact stand up to the fable? Will the fable stand up to the fact? It sounds like it's coming out of the sands right now. My thanks to my guest today, Nicholas Clapp, author of Sheba, Through the Desert in Search of the Legendary Queen, and Carol Fontaine, professor of Hebrew Scriptures at Andover Newton Theological School. We were also joined earlier by Dr. Ephraim Isaac, director of the Institute for Semitic Studies in Princeton, New Jersey. We had help today at the connection from Glenn Alexander, Kim Bishari, Sean Carberry, Darren Manoogian, and Doug Sugarts, and from intern Tom Gilmore. The Connection is produced by Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Michael Cavanaugh, Allison McAdam, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Ben Walker. Our senior producer is Graham Smith, our little local Queen of Sheba. To continue the Queen of Sheba conversation, you can visit our website, theconnection.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We've made the Queen of Sheba Connection. Join us again. Nina Totenberg will be in tomorrow. Don't miss it. Thanks for joining us on The Connection.
This is